Today, of course, is the 11th of March. In Spain, it is known as the 11th M.E., of course, after the horrendous attack in Madrid on March 11th, 2004, and a political crisis that triggered afterwards to search for those responsible, is the subject of a new Netflix documentary that is going to cause a lot of soul searching, I think, and a lot of looking towards the future and looking back from what we can learn from the past. Joining me live on the line is Guy Hedgeco. Guy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles.
Good to have you with us. Once the MA is a date that lives in infamy, of course. Those of us who were in Spain at the time remember the shock, the revulsion, having read through your articles recently on the subject, I find it quite staggering that there's a generation growing up who are being maybe misinformed or not taught what exactly happened on that day.
Yes, that's right. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that it's such a divisive episode for Spain. Obviously, it was tremendously traumatic, just purely on a human tragedy level, the loss of 193 lives, around 2,000 people injured. It was the biggest terrorist attack that Spain had ever seen. And, you know, Spain obviously was used to terrorism, unfortunately, because of the threat of Basque terrorism by ETA. But this was on a different scale. And it became extremely divisive because of the political response to it, really. The government at the time, the conservative government, José María Aznar, insisted in the wake of the attack that it had been carried out by ETA, which was the, if you like, the most obvious threat to Spain at the time. But it became increasingly apparent that it hadn't been carried out by ETA, and there was mounting evidence that that hadn't been the case. And the reason, or the main reason that this all became so politically explosive, if you like, was that there was a general election 3 days after the attack, which Aznar's popular party were expected to win. As it became increasingly apparent that the government of Aznar was possibly misleading intentionally or simply due to its mindset, the Spanish public over who had carried this out, there was a huge backlash, and that mobilized many voters to come out, particularly left-leaning voters who felt they were being lied to by their government, because they felt that there was this evidence that this was a jihadist attack, not an ETA attack. And it led to a surprise electoral victory for the Socialist Party. And I think because of that election surprise, that shock victory for the Socialists, it remains a very divisive issue. Many people feel that the Socialists took advantage of that situation, that there were lies being told by the Socialists. Many people on the left remain angry that the Aznar government misled them over who was responsible for this attack. And as you say, there are many younger Spaniards who really don't know exactly what happened. They know that there was an attack of some kind, but it's become a sort of, certainly in schools, it's become a taboo subject that teachers don't want to talk about this because it remains very politically divisive.
And one of the things as well is the fact that, if you like, you know, the 11th of March, certain sections will say, well, this is where a lot of the quote unquote problems that we have in Spain today, or a lot of the issues that we have in Spain today, sort of get their nucleus, their genesis, because, you know, we hadn't had a jihadist attack in Spain. And then suddenly this was a major thing. And obviously Spain has a fantastic multicultural mezcla of all tribes and traditions and faiths. And suddenly, you know, people were looking askance to their neighbors and perhaps those who'd been living in Spain for a very long time.
Yes, that's right. I think it was very difficult for a lot of ordinary Spaniards to accept that they'd been attacked by a terrorist cell that was from outside, had its roots outside Spain. And what more recent research has shown is that this attack was specifically a response to the Spanish intelligence service, the security services dismantling of an Al-Qaeda cell In Spain, just a few years earlier. Many people thought this was a response to Spain's support for the Iraq invasion in 2003. What has emerged is that actually it was a response to an earlier dismantling of an Al-Qaeda cell here. And I think many Spaniards found that very difficult to grasp, the idea of, you know, a jihadist cell that had links to the Middle East. That was all very disconcerting, and it was perhaps almost more easier to accept that it was simply ETA that had carried this out. So, you know, it remains extremely divisive and difficult for many people to accept. And you'll still hear people, you know, whether it's taxi drivers or people out in the street, I've heard people, you know, even in recent years say, oh, we'll never know who carried out this attack. We'll never know the full truth of this, even though the full truth really is out there.
I mean, the full truth, I mean, you can argue, because obviously Spain was then glued to its TV stations for news, even though some newspapers were still, national newspapers were still saying, for, you know, until a very late stage that it was, you know, a Basque attack. And then, of course, we had the, almost the live on TV detonation of the bombs in that Madrid block when they found themselves cornered.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was a sort of just several days of horror in Spain, which began with the train bombings, continued with the, what you know, you mentioned there, the detonation of those bombs, or the self-immolation of those other terrorists in Leganés, just outside Madrid. And I think what that underlined was that, I mean, the intention there of those terrorists was to kill the security, the members of the security forces who were going after them, who'd surrounded that building. And at the time, I remember very clearly there was a feeling that this was a new threat for Spain. This was something that Spain was really not prepared for. You know, that Spain had for so long been geared towards dealing with the terrorism of ETA, but this was something new, but, you know, in terms of having the people on the ground who could understand Arabic and who could tune into jihadist terrorists who are communicating, who could deal with a different kind of terrorist threat to that posed by ETA. So it posed all kinds of new problems, and it wasn't just something that shocked Spanish society. It was something that the authorities, the government, the security forces, the intelligence services all had to suddenly sit up and adjust to this.
Because if you like, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, but, you know, ETA were an old school terrorist movement. There was a sort of socialist aspect to it, very, very left wing socialist aspect to it, but, you know, behind the Basque cause. And you know, the Spanish authorities had, you know, we were sort of kind of on the way to peace with this one. And yet the emergence of Al-Qaeda was something that was entirely, well, for the majority of the Spanish public, you know, we hadn't seen anything like this.
Yes, and you know, ETA at the time in 2004, ETA was very weak, really. You know, its of structure militarily, if you like, it was it had been weakened heavily by a string of arrests, and the authorities had really clamped down on them, along with the cooperation with the French authorities as well, where in France, the ETA often, or its members often, took refuge there, and so ETA was in a very weak position. And the fact that this attack in 2004 took place on commuter trains that were in Madrid or coming into Madrid, full of, you know, working class people, many of them immigrants, and that there had been no warning ahead of this, all of that told people who knew about this kind of thing, terrorism experts, a lot of them, many of them outside Spain, were saying, this does not look like a typical ETA attack. This is very different. ETA does not operate like this. This looks much more like a jihadist attack. So the signs were there from the very beginning when the blast took place that this is very atypical for ETA. And almost immediately we had denials from people representing ETA or close to ETA saying, this had nothing to do with ETA. This was someone else. And I do remember it was a very confused picture at the time because, for example, you know, the Prime Minister, José María Aznar, he was telephoning the editors of newspapers that same day saying to them, this is ETA. We know this is ETA. So in your newspaper, you have to say clearly that this is ETA. And one or two newspapers accepted that. El País newspaper, which wasn't a supporter of Aznar, accepted that. And its headline in the next morning's newspaper was, you know, terrorist massacre by ETA. So it was a very confusing picture for 2 or 3 days between that the blast themselves and the election 3 days later.
Would you say that was kind of how Athanar approached his politics, sort of head on, and I'm right and everybody else is not the same, and therefore there was this election coming up, this general election, and it threw Zapatero into a position that some would argue the socialists weren't really prepared for.
Yes, I mean, it was so unexpected. I think many people felt that this, on Al Qaeda's part, on the terrorist part, this may have been sort of planned as an attack specifically for this date, because it could affect the outcome of the election. Now, the sort of research by experts, those who are interviewed in the film, the documentary you mentioned, they say that that's not the case. That the Spanish election was not, in the diary of these terrorists. They've been planning this for months or even years before this took place. But clearly it became a political issue, the attack, immediately, and the response to it was absolutely crucial. Now, if Aznar had responded to it, for example, by getting opposition politicians around him and saying, it doesn't matter who carried this out, we will stand together against this, I think there's a very good chance that his party would have won the election anyway, if he'd sort of been rather more open and, let's say, honest, and not insisted so much that that ETA had been responsible, but simply said, we will stand together, socialists and conservatives, people across the spectrum. That might have been a more constructive way of approaching this, I think. And we might not have seen the terrible sort of rancor and division on a political level, which we saw over the following days, months, and even years.
And we talk about the rancor, and I just want to touch on this point, and then I want to move on a little bit from it. But we have Atocha station, well known, the most famous station in Madrid, is in the process of being renamed, and that itself has become a political hot potato.
Yes, it has. The Spanish government has announced plans to rename the station after Almudena Grandes, who is a very well-known Spanish novelist who died a few months ago at the age of 61 from cancer. Now, many people were celebrating the idea that the station was going to be named after her. She's a very popular, best-selling novelist. However, she is seen as a left-wing figure, a very outspoken leftist public figure. And that fact has upset many people on the right, who say that the fact that the station is being renamed after her is a political move. It's evidence that the government of Sanchez is just trying to use this as a political football. So that has created something of a backlash on the right. The Popular Party, some members of the Popular Party, the mayor of Madrid, Almeida, was upset about it. Members of Ciudadanos as well, who govern with the Popular Party in Madrid, have opposed the move as well. So, I mean, that's just, I think, one more example of the kind of day-to-day bitterness and rancor that we see in Spanish politics over relatively minor issues.
Away from the politics, though, this documentary that's coming out on Netflix looks at the personal stories. And there are, as always in these situations, just awful tragedies. I mean, I remember watching as the conference center was turned into a makeshift morgue, and you saw Ecuadorians and Romanians, you talk about immigrants, people who made up, the majority of immigrants who were killed in the attacks. I remember the stories of rescue services hearing mobile phones going off in rucksacks inside the carriages as people try to check. I remember this tale of a couple who put the car in the garage for a service and went in on a train and were killed, leaving their children orphaned. I mean, there are those stories as well. Away from the political gamesmanship and point scoring, that is the real tragedy of Once Eme.
Yes, it is. I mean, that obviously is the main tragedy at the heart of this. I mean, I remember very clearly I was living quite near Atocha on the day of the attacks. I was in my flat. They happened very early in the morning. The only reason I didn't hear the blasts, or certainly the blasts in Atocha, was that I just had some soundproof windows installed in my flat. And I think otherwise I would have heard them. This is in the days before smartphones. We had internet, but I didn't have internet in my flat. It was very hard to sort of get a full picture of what was happening at the time. It just came out in bits and pieces. And then obviously the death toll crept up throughout the day. And you started to get a picture of the scale of the devastation that had been wreaked by this, which was unprecedented in Spain, even though it's a country which is used to terrorism, or at the time was used to terrorism. I went into my office at El País newspaper later on in the morning, and then there you got a full grasp of what was going on, and we had a minute's silence outside the newsroom around midday. And this was well before the death toll had reached, 193, the final death toll. But people were really shocked. Spain had not had to face up to something like this. And as you say, the personal stories at the heart of this really drive it home. The people who were orphaned, the people who lost children, the people who lost other family members, and the people who survived but who were traumatized by the blast itself. You see this very, very clearly in the film, that something like that stays with people forever.
And this film has taken over a decade to put together, to make, and I think that says something about the intention of the filmmakers and the sensitive subjects that we're dealing with here.
Yes, I met with Jose Gomez, the director. He's a Mexican director who made this. As you say, it took him a whole decade to research this and make the film. It's got the involvement of Kevin MacDonald, who directed a number of documentaries, The Last King of Scotland. He's an executive producer on this. It was very interesting talking to Jose Gomez about how he handled the people he interviewed in this documentary, because it's obviously such a sensitive issue. How do you go about interviewing someone who's lost a child in a terrorist attack? And a lot of the interviews were carried out abroad, so he's traveling all around with his team. But he said he always had a team of psychologists on hand for the people he was interviewing, because he said if you interview someone in depth about something that traumatic, it will destroy them, even if they're doing it of their own free will. For the next few days or weeks, they will be in bits. And so his team, not only were they providing therapists in situ in the place where they were being interviewed, but in the following days and weeks, they followed up and telephoned the people who they'd interviewed to check they were okay, to talk about it with them. So this is a tremendous amount of work, which is, it's not strictly filmmaking. A lot of it is sort of just handling the people you've interviewed in the right way. It's an extremely intensive way of working.
I was going to say, in a world of soundbite journalism and TikTok reporting, to go to that depth of detail and also have the follow-up, when you could say that a lot of documentary makers are reality TV, I know this isn't reality TV, it's sort of slash and burn broadcasting, but that shows the sensitivity which the film deals with. You've described it as excellent. Do you think it's something that we can gain a better understanding of why and the effect it had on a personal level to the people involved, and also on a political level and a social level in Spain? Because it has made a change, and here we are now almost 20 years later.
Yes, I think it does several things. It first of all, it gives a voice to the victims in a very compassionate way, and they tell their stories without any filter, really, and that comes across certainly in the first half of the film. Then the second half concentrates more on how and why this happened, the logistics, explaining, piece by piece, who was involved in this, why, what their motivation was. And I think in that sense, it's very important, because it really seems to me this very much is the last word in explaining clearly how and why this happened. And it sort of scotches any conspiracy theories that are out there, which are still swirling around out there in some Spanish media or in sort of fringe groups online. It scotches all that, and it says, you know, this is exactly what happened. And it has Fernando Reynares, who's the leading expert probably in Spain on terrorism and certainly on jihadist terrorism, explaining all that. And then something else which it does, which you mentioned there, is it looks into the political legacy of all this and how all of this had an impact on Spanish politics after that general election as well.
Because you said in a recent article in the Irish Times that Spanish democracy lost something in that day. So you could almost say this, you know, with this attack, we went down the road to where we are at the moment in terms of the rise of various parties and the break on the Partido Popular.
Yes, I mean I do feel very strongly that something changed. That day, I mean, José Gómez, the director of the documentary, said to me, March 11, 2004 was a watershed moment. I mean, I think that is something that everyone can agree on across the political spectrum, that something did change there. They may disagree on it on pretty much everything else. But I think what happened 18 years ago had a fundamental impact on Spanish politics. People on the right felt that they'd been cheated, that an illegitimate government had gone into power, the socialists. And many people on the right feel that that was the beginning of a sort of two decades of negativity in Spanish public life, that since then that we've seen leftist politics, we've seen Catalan and Basque separatists having an input in the national government and trying to their regions trying to break away from Spain. And these people would claim that all that can be traced back to March 11th. And there is a saying among some people on the political right, I think fairly fringe groups, that since March 11th, everything is March 11th. They have this sort of motto, which sort of encapsulates that idea that March 11th is to blame for all this leftist separatist politics that we've seen ever since then. I wouldn't take that view. But what I do think is that the trust in Spain's government at the time was shaken so fundamentally, and trust in Spanish institutions was shaken at the time, and trust in Spanish politicians as well and political parties was shaken so deeply that I think that has been felt down in the 18 years that have followed. And the polarization that we see today, I wouldn't attribute all of that to the attacks on March the 11th, 2004, but I think there isn't a cause and effect there. There has been an influence in terms of what happened 18 years ago and the deep rancor and polarization that we see in Spanish political life today. There is a link there.
The new Netflix documentary is called 11M Terror in Madrid. Go and check it out if you can. I've been speaking to Guy Hedgeco. Guy, if people want to find out more information, follow you and find out what you're up to, which is always interesting, to put it mildly, I know there's a website. Where can people find you?
Well, I have my website, guyhedgeco.com, if you can spell my surname. I'm on Twitter. And my Twitter handle is just Hedgeco, HEDGECOE. And yeah, I'm covering Spain for the BBC and the Irish Times and one or two other media as well, including Politico, covering, well, any interesting stories that I see out there.
Go forth and follow Guy on Twitter and all the socials. Guy Hedgeco, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thanks very much, Giles. Always a pleasure.